It's good to see you here this morning. Always appreciate the chances we have to study God's Word. Looking in Job chapter 37. Let's see, we shouldn't have read over anything. All right. So the plan today to get through Job chapter 37. We'll see if we can do that. Maybe start just a little bit talking about chapter 38 if we have time. Just to get our minds back into it, do a quick recap from chapters 35 and 36, which we covered last week. In chapters 35 and 36, we have Elihu condemning Job, first for believing that he had a right to question God, if you remember that. We remember that Job wanted to bring his case before God, and Job was convinced that God wouldn't be able to give him a good answer. He wouldn't be able to respond if he could just talk with Job face to face. So Job wanted that opportunity. But Elihu says he has no right to do that. And then Elihu goes into this argument about how when a man sins, he's not really a threat to God. He's not putting God out. And likewise, when a man does something good or righteous, he's not really benefiting God in any way. This is coming from Elihu. But rather that the effects of a man's actions are going to be felt by other men and women. So, you know, if we're kind, other people will benefit from our kindness. If we're cruel, other people will suffer because of our cruelty. But God's not a victim or a beneficiary of either one of those things, according to Elihu. And I think the point he's trying to get to is he's trying to convince Job of God's ability to judge impartially, that God's not going to be swayed because he's personally, I guess, slighted or personally benefited by something that someone did, but he's going to judge impartially. After making that point, Elihu gets into this thing about how when people who go through this trial, they will either sincerely ask God for help or they're just going to complain and ultimately become indignant. And that if we're going through a trial and we take it as an opportunity to complain, if we take it as an opportunity to become angry that God would allow this to happen to us, that God's not going to hear that. He's not going to listen to us or try to restore us again. So again, you know, I've brought this up a few times. You know, obviously Elihu believes that's what Job is feeling. He feels like Job is angry that God allowed this to happen to him. He puts Job into that kind of category of the kind of person he's talking about. And I don't think that's what's happening with Job. I don't think Job is feeling this indignation that God allowed this to happen to him. I think that he's committed to approaching his situation objectively. And he's trying to consider all possibilities, and he knows that he didn't do anything wrong coming into it. So what conclusion is left other than God is his enemy now? It's not the correct conclusion, but given what he knows and given his commitment to approach the situation just objectively, that's the conclusion he's arriving at. So I think that's what's going on with Job. That's different, although I don't think Job obviously isn't right in that. God's not his enemy. But that's different than blaming God or getting mad at God that these things happened to him. I don't think that's exactly where Job is. And again, you can go back through some of Job's discourse and we could discuss that in more detail. But I think he tries to make it clear that's not where he is. He's just trying to explain it is what it is, right? God has a right to do this, and he's doing it, and I'm powerless to stop it. That's what's happening. So then getting back into chapter 36, that was pretty much chapter 35. In 36, Elihu argues that God is not going to allow like wicked rulers and wicked kings to rule forever, but he punishes them when they act wickedly, and when he punishes them, it leads them to repentance. And you can see, first of all, this is in keeping with that process of restoration that Elihu talked about back in chapter 34, I think it was 34, when he talks about how, you know, whoever this interceding angel person is going to have pity on this person when they're suffering for the evil that they've done, and that deity or whatever that thing is, that angel or whatever it is going to approach God and petition for the man, and then God will relent and he will hear the man's prayer. This is all, again, coming from Elihu, right? So I think that's kind of in keeping with that, the idea that God's punishing for the purpose of bringing to reconciliation. He's trying to restore through punishment. And I think the idea that God would break us down in order to restore us is not an unscriptural principle. I think you see that idea in other places too. But on the other hand, sometimes bad people do bad things and they live long, prosperous lives. I mean, sometimes that happens. And Job observed that. And he called out his friends and said, if I'm wrong in that, someone show me how. Like, show it to me. How am I wrong? How am I wrong in that? There are people who don't care about God at all, who go to the grave, and even after they die, they're honored, right? Their graves are still honored by people. So you've got a couple of things that are in tension there. And again, Job's integrity kind of depended on that being the case, because if he could show how the wicked sometimes went unpunished in this life, then it would prove that God wasn't doing this to him because he did something wrong, right, in a roundabout way. So his argument kind of depended on that. He's arguing for his integrity there. So then in chapter 36 again, Elihu closes the chapter by admonishing Job to remember God's greatness. Back in chapter 36 and verse 31, you have Elihu talking about God's power and his benevolence, proving that he is a worthy judge of his people. And Elihu says things like, even when the lightning strikes, it hits its mark, it's restrained and it's purposed by God. And I think what Elihu's starting to lead into, and what we'll see in chapter 37, is this idea that these things all happen for a reason, that God's doing these things and he's controlling things, and even things that man can't comprehend when we look at it. We can't possibly see a lightning strike and understand how that's going to fit in with the whole grand scheme of everything that God has planned, right? But Elihu argues, but that's what's going on. God has a plan and he's working it out, and it's happening in things that we can't even begin to understand how it all fits together. So an interesting thought there, and something that I want to give consideration to, because there's some tension in that argument as well, as to how much does God really control? How much is he affecting for his own purpose versus are sometimes things happening just because they happen? You know? So we're going to give some consideration of that in chapter 37, because I think Elihu gets into that. So any questions before we start looking at chapter 37? All right. Job chapter 37. I'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 13. Elihu's still speaking here. He says, at this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars, he thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. For to the snow he says, fall on the earth, likewise to the downpour, his mighty downpour. He seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom he made may know it. Then the beasts go into their lairs and remain in their dens. From its chamber comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen fast. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around and around by his guidance, to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world. Whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. All right, so looking through this first section here, the first thing that kind of jumps out to me is how Elihu is personifying God in a storm a bit. He talks about how, you know, his voice is like roaring thunder. And that's a little bit ironic, a little bit foreshadowing, I guess, looking ahead what's about to happen in the next chapter, in chapter 38, when God's literally going to appear in a storm, right? So that jumps out to me at first. What Elihu's talking about here, I think, is the imagery he's using is when God is acting, man cannot react. I think that's kind of the point that he's trying to make here. It's like the idea in verses 7 and 8, where he seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom he made may know it. Then the beasts go into their lairs and remain in their dens. So the idea is like when you have these bad storms that are raging, or when snow and ice are covering the ground, then especially as would have been the case back then, like men aren't going to be outside working in that, right? They're going to have no choice but to go find some shelter and hunker down until it passes. Or if it's snowing and icing real bad, they're just going to have to wait it out until the ground thaws and they can get back to their work. So when God brings these things upon them, the effectiveness of men to carry out their tasks are restrained. And you know, similarly with animals in verse 8, they're just going to go to their dens or their lairs, and they're going to kind of wait it out there. So I think the idea is that, you know, when it's just first and foremost, I think Elihu trying to rebuke Job in the context of remember God's greatness, right? When God acts, man's not going to be able to do anything to thwart that. Man's not going to be able to carry out his own plans. And I think Elihu's about to tie that back around to, and you want to call him into some court and question him? You really think that's going to work out for you? So I think it's kind of in that context. Let's look again at verses 12 and 13. And I want to flesh out a little bit more that tension that I mentioned before in Elihu's argument. It may not be a flaw necessarily, but it could be. It could be an inconsistency, but there's definitely some tension I just want to bring out in some of the things he's saying. So in verses 12 and 13 again, he says, "They turn around and around by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen." So the way I read this is it seems to me that Elihu is arguing that God causes all these things to happen for a reason. That's how I read it. And Elihu is about to argue again, kind of like we talked about before, that there's not going to be any one of us humans who's going to be able to make sense of all of that, right? We're not going to be able to put the pieces of the puzzle together just by observing things that are happening in nature. But rest assured, there's a reason for it, even if we don't get it, okay? I think that obviously God created and sustains this existence, and he does that with purpose, and he does that with intention. And I think the point is well made, and it's very true, and I think this is why Elihu sounds a little bit like God in some of his argumentation in this chapter. God's going to make a similar point that, you know, you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, and I think that that's true as well. The point's well taken that there are things happening that we don't know about. There's things going on that we just don't have access to, so we therefore should not presume to know too much or to try to speak too much about why God's doing something, which in and of itself is a little bit ironic, because that's kind of what Elihu's doing. I mean, he's literally saying, "I am speaking for God," right? So there's a little bit of irony there too. So yes, it's true that God creates and sustains this existence. He does so with purpose and intention. And it's true there's many things happening that we don't know what that's about. But here's where the tension comes in. The reality is bad things do happen. And if we go all in on this idea that God does everything for a reason, then is God to blame for the bad things that happen? That's the tension we have to deal with if we go all in on Elihu's argument. Okay? Just so you know that exists. I would argue that, yeah, bad things do happen, but I'm not ready to say that's God's fault that bad things happen. So how do we work through that? How do we work through that? And I'll get into that more, but Kelly, you had a point or a question.
I remember untruth. I'm not sure that we can know. But, you know, for instance, you were asking about the bad things that happened. Some pretty horrible things happened to our brothers and sisters in Christ in the first century at the hand of the Jews and even through the Romans. How do we explain that? God allowed that? I would have to say yes, he did.
Right.
God allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
He certainly could have stopped it. It was within his power to just not let that happen.
Yeah.
So, is God at fault for that? Well, at the end of Job, his friends come to him and they comfort him over all the evil that the Lord brought upon him. You know, that's an interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the Spirit records that. So what do we make of that statement?
Right.
God is good, and he seeks for good. And the end of the Lord, even in James 5, in summing up Job's experience, was that he was full of mercy and compassion. So I think the problem comes in if we try to substitute what we think is our judgment about what God may be allowing to happen or not allowing to happen within the lens of our view.
Yeah.
I think that's where we get into trouble.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because we have to look at this and understand that within the context of Job, God is kind of like actively allowing this to happen. Like he's permitting Satan to go do this to Job. So it is a little bit of a it's a little different than what we've experienced today, right? So we can't just like necessarily take everything that's happening in Job and just say this is how God operates all the time everywhere. It seems like this is a bit of an exception in some cases. But, you know, I think it starts for me with the idea of free will. God has created us in such a way that we have free will, and we're going to be able to make our own decisions. And if we're allowed to make our own decisions, then we are allowed to make bad decisions. We are allowed to abuse that privilege that he's given us, at least for a time. Now, God's not going to allow that indefinitely. He's told us there's a judgment coming, and he's told us there's accountability for what we say and do and think. But the reality is people can choose to do bad things. That seems obvious to say, but it's our reality. People can choose to do those bad things. So, you know, one example that just really sticks in my mind for some reason, it's not really specific to the book of Job at all, but, you know, I think about, I know a couple, actually several couples, who their marriage is not their first marriage, and they have come out of previous marriages that were bad situations where their spouses cheated on them and did all kinds of bad things. And after getting out of those marriages, they are married to another person, and I've seen that second relationship flourish. I've seen them have children, and I've seen them, you know, blessings come upon that family. Now, am I ready to say that God wanted that first marriage to fail so that second marriage that's flourishing would come about? Was that his plan? I don't think so. And that's where I'm kind of wanting to get out of the realm of like, maybe we should stop looking at everything and trying to figure out why it happened the way it happened and understand that really what I see more from God, at least from what I can see and what I can study, is God is more into the business of taking what's broken and fixing it. He can take a bad situation and he can turn it around and cause good to happen from it. And that's what I've personally seen more and more in my life. One example of this, just from personal experience, this kind of sticks with me as well. When I was a kid, I think I was in third grade, I broke my arm twice in the same year, same spot, broke it twice, different ways, but happened twice in the same year. And at one point, it had been several weeks after the second time I had broken it, we had to go in for a checkup. And they looked at it, and the doctors determined that it wasn't healing properly. So the only recourse was they had to break it again and reset it. So third time, I broke my arm three times in 1 year when I was a kid. And that kind of sticks with me when I think about this point. It's, yes, true, the doctor broke my arm, right? The doctor took my arm and he broke it. But the doctor's not to blame for me having a broken arm. We get that, right? We can see the difference. So I kind of just use that as my own analogy to work through some of these things. Yeah, God can fix what's broken, and sometimes he's going to have to break us down a little bit, or maybe even a lot, to fix what's broken, but that doesn't mean he broke us. There's a difference between those things. And we have to be careful when we start thinking that everything happens for a reason. I don't believe that. That's not where I am right now. I think God can cause all things to lead to his glory and can lead to good for us, but I don't think that I'm ready to blame God for the evil that comes upon us. And having said all that, it's a little bit different with Job because God is kind of actively involved here. He's kind of watching this play out specifically with Job. There's this different thing going on that we don't know what happened with us. So I think that I just wanted to point out that tension in Elihu's argument because I think Elihu seems to be crossing that line a little bit. He's crossing the line between God is chastising you for the reason of restoring you into, look, everything that seems random to us is happening for a reason. I don't think that's really the case. So that's how I'm reading what Elihu is saying right here. Do you have any questions or comments about that?
Yeah, I think you may have just summed up the whole book of Job. Quit trying to figure it all out.
Yeah.
Just let God be God and you be man and let it go.
Yeah.
No matter how bad it gets.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes, you know, asking why this is happening is just not going to produce anything good because we have to accept the reality, like Job and like all of his friends, they don't see the whole picture. And we see this playing out in a way that's leading them down to some wrong conclusions about what's going on. And unfortunately, in their case, it leads to some conclusions about what they think about each other. Right? In the case of Job, he's like the worst sinner ever by this point, according to his friends. So, yeah, Kelly. Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's kind of a contrast, and really want to bring out as a contrast of two responses to bad situations. One is asking God, why did you allow this to happen? And I think to Elihu's credit, that's really where he's trying to get, right? He's trying to get Job to see, you're asking with indignation why God's allowing this to happen to you when you should just be asking him to help. Right, you should be calling out to help for him. Remember in chapter 36, we looked at that and the difference that Elihu said. In fact, I mean, I really like that verse. I think it was 13. Job 36:13. He says, "The godless in heart cherish anger. They do not cry for help when he binds them." So when bad things happen to you, do you feel like angry? I mean, maybe the initial reaction is, and let's not be too hard on ourselves, okay? We're going to have initial reactions that we're going to have to work through and decide, am I going to continue to feel this way or am I going to get straightened out a little bit in my own mind about it? But let's not cherish anger. Let's not hang on to it. And let's not find our refuge from trials that come upon us in the idea that I'm just upset about it. Let's not get our solace from that, okay? Because I think some people can. They can latch on to that anger and kind of use it to get them through the tough situation. And I think we need to be careful about that. And Elihu is very much on point when he talks about that. But again, I think he's crossing a little bit too far now in chapter 37 by arguing, it seems to me that God's allowing everything to happen for a reason. Yeah, Rick?
Yeah, I think there's a concept called self-reference criteria. That's when we see the world through just our eyes. And it's usually used in marketing so that when you have different cultures, they'll market something and they'll do it from their perspective, but it may become offensive to another culture. Okay? As I think about this, we have a tendency to apply self-reference criteria. We look at things as good and bad through our eyes as humans in this world. If there's collateral damage due to an event and somebody is living right with God, isn't it a wonderful thing that they now spend their eternity with God? I mean, when you really sit back and think about it, what we view as a bad thing to happen could actually be a very glorious thing from God's perspective. And so it's really hard for us not to apply human ethics to this whole line of thought.
Yeah.
And maybe the takeaway is human ethics really don't come into play when we're talking about God. We live in this world, but we're not of this world, right? And I mean, this whole concept of God's
hand
to stick a little.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think that, you know, our standard of our ethics need to be tuned to God's standard. And I think that we can, it's difficult. It's difficult to go there. It's difficult to find the good in bad situations like that. And I think of like abortion, you know, like, are we rejoicing that these children are now dead in heaven? I have every confidence that they are. But I think that that doesn't make the abortion a good thing, right? It's not a matter of me reshaping, I know you're not saying this, but it's not a matter of me reshaping my ethics to see that as a good thing that's happening, but rather understanding that, again, how God acts, how I seem to see him act is taking bad situations and making them right. At some point, in some way, eventually, he will set it right. Right.
That's a great point, because as we've studied, it makes no sense to me whatsoever, but the killing of babies has happened since the beginning of time, right? How many stories have we heard about every child under the age of two was to be slaughtered, right? To try to avert a prophecy. And even today, we still struggle with that today. And I do not, my brain cannot comprehend why this is still a struggle for mankind today. But it is nothing new. And as Solomon said, there is nothing new under the sun. And we will continue to have, and James says, consider it all joy, the trials and tribulations that we face, because it produces endurance. And it's just a part of life that we have to wrestle with. And so, like I said, it's just we can't help ourselves but apply our human experience into defining what is good and what is bad.
And I'm not even going to be ready to go so far as Elihu says, because I'm thinking as you're talking back to Elihu, talking about how, you know, when we do good things, other men benefit. When we do evil things, other men suffer. Obviously, abortion is the prime example of that. I mean, this is there any better example of innocence being persecuted at the hands of evil men? And I know that Elihu's point is that, you know, we're going to suffer for the consequences of our own stuff, and that doesn't really impact God. I think God is grieved by those things. But I think that he's also not going to allow his grief to act in a way that is unjust. So again, you know, it's hard working through these arguments, because just like if you sit down with anybody else and have a discussion and there's, you know, these philosophical ideas that are kind of floating around, it's going to be a mix of some really good points and some stuff that, well, no, you made a really good point here, but you're kind of going too far over here. And I think that's what we're seeing right here. Yeah, Kelly.
But think about faithful prophets who lived at the time of Ahab or at the time of Manasseh. This man ruled Manasseh for 55 years is in power. And he did a lot of evil at the beginning of that. And can you imagine the faithful among the Jews who are wondering, why is God allowing this king to continue to do all these things, you know? And then God said, judgment's coming. But it came, what, 130, 140 years later. Finally, at Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar builds the siege wall around Jerusalem. He brings the city down. You know? So yeah. We don't have that perspective. We think it's going to happen within the bridge point in the purview of our vision, but that's not God's view.
Yeah.
We have to be careful about looking at things within our purview and thinking, well, God isn't doing anything about this. We don't know that. You're looking at your vision. God's vision is wider.
Yeah.
We can't see all the pieces.
Yeah, and you know, I suspect that when God does execute judgment on the world, even those who are judged, I think, are going to say, yeah, he got that right. As much as it's going to be to their own demise, and as terrible as it's going to be, he got it right. He's going to get it right. Yeah, Britt?
Rick's and Rob's point earlier, Ellie's too, we tend to put God in a box that we bound with our understanding and knowledge. One thing that I've always asked, and the question that comes into my mind is, how could it be worse? We have no idea how much worse this place could be. And we have no idea how much he's working behind the scenes to make sure it's tolerable.
Great point.
We don't have that capability of understanding. To Rod's point, we shouldn't bother trying. To Rick's point, we shouldn't keep projecting our thoughts on God. We need to actually come to the resolution that after years and years of study, there are two facts that we know of. One, that God exists. And two, that we're not him. Mm-hmm. And if we can accept that, then we can move forward and stop processing how we handle things. But that gives us more insight into who we are. We are not God. We were created as image. We're not him. We don't get to make those decisions. We don't get to do that because we don't have the capability to do it.
Yeah.
And that's something that we don't accept. As a human, you cannot accept that. Can't say, I don't have control over this. It bugs them. It bejeeves out of everybody when you try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something you have to have, that serenity, that acceptance that God's in control. He's doing the things that make sense. I don't understand.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening. And that it seems this has been going on, as Rick said, from the beginning of time.
Yeah.
And Elihu has fallen into that trap. I know exactly what God's doing. I know why he's doing it. And as soon as somebody says, I know why God's doing something, that's the biggest red flag you should ever see of anyone saved.
Yeah.
Because we know for a fact he can't and never will. He might know a little snippet here that's been divinely inspired in the Word of God.
Yeah, we got to be really careful to make, I hesitate to say never, but I right now I feel like I would never be so bold as to state what Elihu has stated about how one with perfect knowledge is with you.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Hear now the words of the Lord.
Yeah.
Wow. Better be right. I'm going to have to move on because we got like 3 minutes to cover, I think, 40 verses. So... maybe not 40. That's an exaggeration. Let's go ahead and just try to finish chapter 37. Verse 14. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind? Can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. Shall it be told him that I would speak? Did a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? So Elihu here is speaking more to the greatness of God. And I think it comes around to a rebuke again in verses 19 and 20, because this is what Job wanted. He wanted to go speak with God about these things. And Elihu is calling his attention to the fact that, Job, you've already stated you wish to be where God isn't, basically, by saying, cover me in deep darkness. So how well do you think that's going to work out? Someone approaching God wanting to be covered in deep darkness. How well are you going to be able to convince him with that type of attitude? Not very well. So again, good arguments, but the irony remains that Elihu doesn't actually understand why these things happened to Job. And he himself is making some unproven assumptions about Job's character. As we talked about, again, you know, there's this mix of good and bad, I think, in some of the argumentation. Some of his points are really well made. Some of his points, not so much. And some of it conflicts with some of the rest of it. There's some tension or maybe even an inconsistency. But what you have here, I think Elihu's, his arguments, however much tension there may be intrinsically to them, they are pretty effective in exposing the inconsistencies of Job's thinking. Because here Job is asking to be covered in deep darkness while simultaneously asking, I want to talk to God about this. And Elihu's like, you can't ask for both things. That doesn't make sense. And that jumped out to me because I can relate to that type of exchange. And I will add, unfortunately, what strikes a chord with me is how we see people sometimes when they get into a debate, they're willing to compromise on their own intellectual integrity for the purpose of exposing the problem in how someone else is thinking or acting. Sometimes maybe we're doing this and we don't realize it, but other times I think it can be done willingly. Like we may take the idea, maybe have you ever thought this idea, like, well, I may not be perfect, but I know how to expose that guy, right? So just be aware of that. Let's try to make sure as a primary importance that our hearts and our minds are in the right place, even if we can compromise on that for the purpose of exposing the error in somebody else. Let's not rush to do that. We're about out of time. I'm gonna close just on one observation. It's a bit of a tangent, and then we'll pick up in verse 21. And there's not a lot left to cover from Elihu, and we'll get into chapter 38 next week. This is just a tangent, but we spoke a month or so ago about how people might go to certain passages in Job to argue for how the Bible predicted modern scientific discoveries. And I just wanted to call attention again to verse 18. Can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? Is the sky, from what we know today, a hard cast metal mirror? No, it's not. Did at least Elihu believe that it was? Yeah, he did. He did. And it doesn't seem like no one's given a chance to debate him on that, but he seems to talk about it like this is common knowledge, right? I'm going to make a point based on this, is kind of how he's talking about it. There are some other verses in Job that people go to, like in Job 26:7, about how God suspends the earth on nothing, and they talk about how, well, the Bible's predicting, you know, it's predating science. It's predicting scientific discoveries. If we hear that, remember Job 37:18 and just pump the brakes before you go down that path. Okay? I don't think it's a good idea to go to the book of Job to argue how the Bible is predicting modern secular scientific thought. We got to be really careful about that. I have argued rather, and I'll say it again, sorry for repeating myself, but I don't see how in what's revealed in the Bible that God is all that concerned with man having a perfect scientific understanding of how he does everything. In fact, I think some of the points of the book of Job go contrary to that. You don't know everything that's going on, so stop pretending like you do. So let's pause before we go down that book. If God go down that path, because if God had wanted to give us a science book, he would have. But he didn't. He gave us things that are concerning us in different ways than that. And remember, too, modern secular origin science and cosmology are incomplete at best, woefully incomplete, almost known by everybody to be wrong. It will be proven wrong at some point. It will be replaced by some other theory at some point. So pump the brakes before you start trying to reconcile what the Bible teaches with what those theories say. Because when those theories go out of fashion, when they go out of date, what is it shown about your ability to interpret the Bible properly? And it's a shifting standard. Let's not connect our understanding of the Bible to anything that's a shifting standard, like secular origin science. Okay, so just again, I have the benefit of the podium, so I'm going to say it again. Just be careful with that stuff, okay? We'll continue next time. We'll pick up in verse 21 and plan to get into Job chapter 38. Thank you so much for your comments.